Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome. You're watching Tip TV Finance. Meet Jenny Hammond and Zach Mir. And with us in the studio is Mike Ingram from BGC Partners. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Jenny. Thank you. Good morning to you both.
So Brexit Wednesday yesterday, Theresa May triggered Article 50, but a lot of investors' attention was diverted to the ECB, which was a misunderstanding about its policy intentions. What's your thoughts, Mike?
Well, this has been a rolling debate. So we've had a situation where the Federal Reserve has now raised rates twice in a period of 3 months. People are looking at the Bank of Japan and thinking maybe they're introducing effectively stealth tapering. In the Eurozone, you had stronger incoming data, higher inflation numbers, and so naturally, in that environment, people are also speculating when the ECB itself is going to start tapering, at least talking about tapering. It was notable the last MPC meeting at the ECB, they did try and dial back against that rhetoric. But, you know, as the data continues to come in strong, they're fighting against it. My own feeling there is that they will be looking to start to indicate tapering, but they still want to see how the next few months of data come in. I don't think they really want to start the firing gun on that until probably about June, because as it stands at the moment, their existing asset purchase program, QE for short, runs until the end of the year, and I think they'd want to probably give the market 3 to 6 months warning if they were to start to taper after that.
That makes sense. Okay, so let's move to the slides. Most popular in business and finance. So Trump to unveil $1 trillion of infrastructure plan in 2017. U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao said that Trump administration would unveil a $1 trillion infrastructure plan later this year, but she did not offer details of funding for projects. Zach, what do you make of it?
It's a bit of a non-story. We already knew. I mean, that's the whole reason why we had a 20% rise in the U.S. stock market. It would really help if we knew the date. And also, the other problem is that even if he unveils this, it might get shot down by his fellow Republicans or any other people. So basically, we're nowhere on that. And until it's actually, you know, unveiled and gets through, it's no use to anyone, really.
Mm. Okay, so let's move on then. So U.S. oil export surge steals more OPEC share. As OPEC tries to keep oil off the world market, U.S. oil producers are pouring more into it, out onto it. The U.S. last week sent more than 1 million barrels a day of crude out of the country, the third biggest export week ever, and doubled the average amount exported in 2016. Mike, thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's back to the future, isn't it? So, I mean, we're almost 2 years on, summer of 2015, since the oil price collapsed. You know, the Saudi-led strategy was to crush US shale, also to defend its own quota within OPEC. We're in 2017, absolutely nothing's changed. All they've allowed the US shale market to do is restructure. It's now profitable, probably down to $35 a barrel. We've still ended up with Saudi Arabia acting as the swing producer within OPEC. Go figure. I mean, I just don't understand what all of this fuss was about. Interesting to note, the last OPEC production figures from the International Energy Authority for February indicated that Saudi Arabia actually increased its production by something like 250,000 barrels a day. And now, of course, the big part of the big debate is whether they're going to extend this freeze beyond June. And I think certainly that is needed in order to put a floor under the oil price, let alone drive it higher. But is there the political will there? You know, it's clear that the Russians are already cheating. Surprise, surprise. So,
isn't it OPEC just doomed? Yeah. It's got no power.
OPEC is dead. OPEC is not a functional cartel. Simple.
Okay, so next slide.
Just before your oil prices go to
$200. Okay, so an exhausting process, which will undoubtedly be covered extensively by the media, has started today. There's a meeting of some EU political party leaders in Malta, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel attending. What could they be speaking of?
We're not allowed to know, are we? Well, look, I mean, there's no formal negotiation until, I think, April 29th. So we've got another, 5 weeks of kind of guessing. For me, what's interesting is the political rhetoric that's going to come out of this because this is as much a political process as an economic process. You say if everybody is sensible and they just look to the economics, yes, we get free trade, we get a whole bunch of stuff, and you know, yeah, we pay a bit of money into the pot.
But all those sensible never the way.
That's not going to happen. Yeah, with politicians that we're talking about, and you know, bear in mind, obviously, there's an ongoing French presidential election, and of course, elections later on in Germany. And I was asking myself how long, because we've had 9 months, we've been in sort of political purdah, effectively. Nobody's, you keep it all quiet, and then as soon as Article 50 is signed and delivered, the rhetorical floodgates are open. And I was thinking, how long is it going to be before some French politician, you know, in the middle of this election goes, oh yeah, you know, the Brits, they smell, or whatever. And I was then, and almost as the thought came out of my head, it was like, oh, Francois Hollande said it's going to be really tough on the UK. And I was like, oh, well, there you go. The answer's 50 minutes. So for me, we might be actually going back to the environment that we saw around about 2012. Yeah. Obviously, the economies are in a better shape generally. But in 2012, I remember quite clearly, we, Eurozone crisis, we had politicians every day of the week saying something dumb and rattling markets. And it was only when the ECB finally stood in, whatever it takes, that you know, market calmed down a little bit. And I think that we are moving into that more event-driven environment. What we know actually may be very little, but what we think we know might be quite a lot.
Yeah.
Create a lot of noise.
There you go.
I know.
Okay,
that.
Moving on. So the economic calendar, what's catching your eye there?
Well, US GDP, if it's a good number, Trump will take credit, and if it's bad, it'll be a relic of the Obama era and a failed economic policy. Initial jobless claims, and they're weekly numbers, and I wouldn't read too much into that. CPI and unemployment rates. Well, I mean, Japan, look, I mean, I would look at the CPI. Unemployment is structurally low in Japan. It's difficult to sack anybody. But the CPI number, obviously, that's what the Bank of Japan has been trying to get up into positive territory for decades now, effectively. It's having some success in that, but only really through currency depreciation. And as we know, all currencies can't be weak against everybody else.
Absolutely.
It's a zero-sum game.
Okay, and speaking of currency, let's move on to your slides, Zach.
Yeah, euro sterling probably the highlight there. Going punters going more long into that. They went down to, it was down at sort of early 30% bullish. Now it's 40%. So a message there, presumably in the wake of the Article 50, and then more bullish on dollar yen, even as it struggles to hold the 110-111 zone. And finally, just to keep an eye on silver there as well, where we've gone more bearish. So. And gold as well, as they are near the top of their recent ranges.
Absolutely. Okay, next slide. And we have the trade of the day, FTSE 100 daily chart, Zach.
Yeah, makes sense on a technical basis. You've got the divergence there and the head and shoulders potentially below 7,400. So I basically, while the FTSE remains below 7,400, you've got a potential of it drifting back towards 7,250 to 73. So sell around 73.80, 7,400, objective 72.60 and stops above 74.50. But I have to say, the trend there still looks rather strong.
Okay, moving on. Broker recommendations, the one that catches my eye is obviously the London Stock Exchange, because just before Article 50 triggered, we saw obviously the failed attempt between the Stock Exchange and the Deutsche Börse. So, Mike, thoughts?
It's interesting, though. I mean, this outcome has been flagged for several weeks now. But, you know, nonetheless, you've actually seen the share price continue to be pretty solid. And I think that it reflects the fact that the London Stock Exchange actually is quite a strong franchise, despite the administrations of Clara First a number of years ago. It's a well-diversified business. Only about 20% of this company's revenue actually comes from trading stuff. A lot of it's on pre-trade services. They've got a big index business, FTSE Russell, and obviously that's a big beneficiary of the move towards passive investment index funds, etc. It's probably actually on the right side of the regulatory environment, because you know, a lot of these derivatives that used to be cleared off the market now have to go through an exchange. LSE is one of them, and also you've got these things about dark pools, these big private block trading venues. Again, a lot of that is being legislated against, moves back on exchange. So I think the bottom line on this one is they're assuming that this is an attractive asset and somebody else will want to tie up with them, and that's the reason you haven't seen it retrace.
Okay, and Zach, you chose next. Why is that?
Just people, the brokers trying to pin the pin a target and a stance on there. One day it's bullish and or overweight in £49, and the next day Barclays Capital underweight in £39. I think it will take a while for the dust to settle there. I'm not really quite sure whether it's a recovery play even from current levels.
Okay, so we're moving on, and I think, Mike, we have your slide, so talk me through these.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was worth revisiting the whole reflation trade. I mean, one of the reasons equity markets have done well over the last 4 or 5 months is because of this idea that economies are picking up, and particularly Donald Trump would, you know, put a following wind on that, largely through fiscal policy and obviously the infrastructure, $1 trillion infrastructure packet is part of that. Now, I showed this actually, this slide on this show, I think early in February, first week of Feb, and I suggested it might indicate that there was the momentum in that trade was actually starting to fail. Yeah. And one of the things that I look at is if you look at stocks which are value stocks as opposed to growth stocks, so they're very, you know, they have value characteristics rather than growth characteristics, you'd actually started to see them underperforming. Now, the point I've made here is that if you think that growth is increasing and broadening out, you pay a lower premium for growth. You expect value to be re-rated against growth stocks. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, is what you've seen. In fact, you can see from that chart, in all these major regions, that process actually already started way before the US election, although I indexed this to 100 on the immediate aftermath. What we've actually seen, really since the start of this year, is those value stocks on a relative basis starting to pull back, and people starting to buy things like tech again, because they're saying, well, that's where all the growth actually is. Now, if we go on to the second slide, this actually kind of jars with the narrative that's out there, because, you know, most economists and strategists will say, well, hang on, the incoming data, I've said it already on this show, the incoming data is better than expected, yeah, particularly in the Eurozone. And you've got this Citibank have these economic surprise indices. And again, if you look at on emerging markets, major economies, obviously includes the US and Japan. And, you know, you kind of lump them together, get some idea of what the global picture is. You know, that's unambiguously in a positive position. You know, we are well into positive territory. Actually, if you were to pull this chart back to on a multi-year basis, that's at multi-year highs now. So hang on, the incoming data is shooting the lights out, apparently. Now, third slide. Maybe the reality check, because you would have thought, logically, that if we're seeing all this incoming data and it's exceeding expectations, you would expect forecasts to be going up for this year, certainly for next year, and you're not really seeing it. So this top panel, this year's GDP forecast, bottom panel, next year's GDP forecast. Is there a trend there? I don't know. I mean, you've got the EU for this year picked up from the middle of last year, but a lot of that, you know, I've rather controversially put the UK in the EU there. But yeah, a lot of that bounce is basically because, you know, people rowing back on these really bad forecasts for the UK. Net for the EU, you're lower than you were for next year than you were going to be. You're lower in emerging markets and you're slightly up in the US. But net, you're thinking, well, hang on, markets have come such a long way. For what? If we really believe that growth is picking up, why is it not in the GDP forecast? Analysts are not normally so shy about upgrading things. They're very shy about downgrading things because then they've got nothing to sell.
Isn't this a relic of, you know, QE just creates zombie economies? It prevents you crashing, but it also prevents you flourishing. And so you just get it. You get a no man's land.
It's like being put in a medically induced coma, effectively. These are the massively broad issues. Get them in 6 minutes, obviously. But yeah, I think that ultimately, nothing that I've seen. And it's interesting to note that despite all of this, you still got the Fed, as I said, talking very hawkishly over the last couple of days. Still seem to be determined to put at least another 2 rate hikes, all other things being equal in the US. I think we're talking about an environment where growth just remains low, which obviously puts a lot of the debates back onto how the wealth that is still there is redistributed and the political issues that arise from that. But also in this environment, because productivity has collapsed, actually higher, not high, not 1970s high, but higher inflation, which means that central banks also have to react to it. So you're talking about higher rates, somewhat higher inflation, and actually lower growth, and that's a very difficult environment for risk assets.
Yeah. Well, sadly, we're going to have to leave it there, Mike, so thank you very much. Our guest today, Mike Ingram from BGC Partners, and coming up next, our proactive investor shares the day.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.